Welcome to Charleston Time Machine. I'm Nick Butler, historian at the Charleston County Public Library. Phoebe Fletcher was an intriguing woman of 18th century Charleston whose unconventional lifestyle earned both derision and respect from her neighbors. Born to a respectable family of unknown origin, she was seduced from the bounds of traditional feminine virtue and thereafter obliged to associate with vicious persons, black and white, to forge an independent career in a patriarchal society. She acquired a colorful reputation as a woman of dubious morals, but Charlestonians long remembered the benevolent care she rendered to ailing soldiers during the American Revolution. Based on this brief outline of her life, we might conclude that Phoebe Fletcher would make an excellent character for a historical novel or a screenplay. Unfortunately, very little information about her survives to illuminate much of her colorful and perhaps brief existence. I've scoured various South Carolina archives in recent years for scraps of documentary evidence of her life and times, but she will likely remain an obscure and enigmatic figure. Considering the many thousands of women residing in early South Carolina who left no documentary traces of their lives, however, we are fortunate to know anything at all about her life. As a sort of tribute to those legions of forgotten women, we can at least attempt to reconstruct a modest biography of Phoebe Fletcher. Our pool of biographical evidence consists of just a handful of documents, nearly a dozen brief newspaper notices published between 1785 and 1791, one receipt for furniture sold in 1788, one census record from 1790, and one paragraph from a book published 60 years after Phoebe's death. The most important of these resources is the memoir published in 1851 by Dr. Joseph Johnson, titled Traditions and Reminiscences, Chiefly of the American Revolution in the South. As I mentioned in a pair of episodes about Charleston's Liberty Tree, this 19th century author was the son of a blacksmith named William Johnson, who was a well-connected veteran of the American Revolution in South Carolina. The younger Johnson, born in 1776, might have known Phoebe Fletcher during his youth in Charleston, and evidently heard about her wartime activities from his patriotic father. Whatever their relationship, Miss Fletcher's actions during the war made a sufficient impression on the Johnson family to sustain her memory across the decades. Joseph Johnson's 1851 monograph includes a paragraph of around 300 words summarizing Phoebe's life story. The text contains unique information that cannot be verified or refuted at the present time, but it nonetheless represents a useful outline of her biography. Rather than simply presenting Johnson's description in one large block, I'd like to dissect his text into smaller bits and combine them with other source materials, annotations, and contextual clues to create a more robust narrative. There were several people bearing the surname Fletcher in the Lowcountry of 18th century South Carolina, but at the moment there is not a sufficient pool of genealogical data to connect Phoebe to any particular branch or family unit. Nothing definitive can be said about her age or place of birth, though I suspect she was born around or perhaps just before the middle of the 18th century. In his 1851 monograph, Joseph Johnson stated that Phoebe had received a decent, virtuous education, words implying that she came from a respectable family of some means. This Fletcher clan, if that was indeed her original surname, either resided in South Carolina at the time of Phoebe's birth or migrated to the colony sometime prior to the American Revolution. After introducing his subject, Dr. Johnson's narrative takes an immediate digression into scandalous territory. At some unspecified point in Phoebe's youth, probably as a young lady of marriageable age, Johnson recalled that, quote, she had been seduced from the paths of rectitude by a young man of fashion, end quote. That is to say, she engaged in some act of premarital sex, consensual or otherwise, during an era when God-fearing Protestants within the British realm condemned such activity as an unforgivable trespass of social propriety. Johnson identified the young man in question simply as a native of Charleston, who evidently harbored no intention of continuing their physical relationship within the traditional legal union of husband and wife. On the contrary, the rakish lad bragged about his intimacy with Miss Fletcher and thereby destroyed her reputation as a respectable, marriageable woman. By gaining intimate knowledge of Phoebe's body and, according to Joseph Johnson, by boasting of his success, this Charleston blackguard, quote, doubly blasted her prospects in life, end quote. No urbane, class-conscious gentleman of that time and place would have considered marrying a woman who had been used in such a fashion, and the conservative social mores of that era offered few opportunities for unmarried women of Phoebe's social class to pursue respectable, independent careers. Being shunned by the virtuous, surmised Dr. Johnson, she had no choice. She could only associate with the vicious. Here we encounter what I consider the central mystery of Phoebe Fletcher's biography. She was evidently ostracized from polite society, but to what extent? How far down the ladder of social hierarchy did she fall? At least one modern historian of Revolutionary-era Charleston has described Phoebe Fletcher as a prostitute, but I believe she was a more complex character than that base term implies. In fairness to her memory and those of countless other forgotten women in similar circumstances, let's consider the context of Johnson's text and clues from the later years of Phoebe's life. Dr. Johnson clearly viewed Phoebe Fletcher as a sympathetic but tragically flawed character, but we must acknowledge that he was not a neutral reporter. He was a man of his times, a conservative, affluent, white, Protestant, amateur historian embedded within a rigidly paternalistic society that condoned and defended the practice of chattel slavery and human trafficking. As such, we can detect elements of personal bias in his text. His 1851 memoir, for example, uses the most politely cryptic language to inform the reader that Phoebe had no choice after her public humiliation, but to associate with persons whom Johnson characterized as vicious. But who, in Johnson's eye, were the vicious people of late 18th century Charleston? Working-class people lacking social polish? Anyone who rejected the conservative social mores of the day? Persons of African and Native American ancestry? Or perhaps all of the above? Rather than embarking on a career as a prostitute after her fall from grace, Phoebe might simply have abandoned the exclusive social sphere of the affluent white minority that dominated South Carolina at the time. I think it is significant that Joseph Johnson prefaced his brief bio of Miss Fletcher by describing her as, quote, a Magdalene of Charleston, end quote. Although some modern readers might consider the term Magdalene a synonym for prostitute, writers of centuries past more commonly used the term to describe a reformed prostitute, or more generally, a benevolent woman with a dishonorable past. In either case, Johnson's text casts Phoebe Fletcher as a victim, an object of sympathy, but she might simply have been an independent woman whose agency and independence offended her dour neighbors. Joseph Johnson revived the memory of Phoebe Fletcher in 1851 as a sidelight to the sprawling and complex struggle for American independence. More precisely, he couched her brief biography within a discussion of the harsh treatment of American soldiers after the British Army captured the former capital of South Carolina in May 1780. There was a Magdalene in Charleston at that time, wrote Johnson, who merited much consideration from the Americans for her devoted attendance on the sick soldiers and her many acts of benevolence to those who were most in need. Because the author was just 4 years old when British forces commenced their oppressive occupation of the capital, he likely learned of Phoebe's memorable acts from older eyewitnesses in the post-war years. Among the most likely sources was Dr. Johnson's own father and his brothers-in-arms, who might have personally received comfort from the young Magdalene. William Johnson, father of Joseph, served as a private in the Charleston Battalion of Artillery and participated in the gallant defense of the town's Tabby Hornwork during the British siege of April and May 1780. 3 months after the town surrendered and British authorities paroled the enlisted American soldiers, Johnson was among dozens of men arrested and confined aboard a British prison ship in Charleston Harbor. 1 week later, he and others were transported to St. Augustine, Florida. After being transferred to Philadelphia in late July 1781, Private Johnson and his comrades returned to Charleston at the conclusion of the war in early 1783. In his youth, during the post-war years, Joseph Johnson evidently heard stories from his father and perhaps other veterans in the community who recalled Phoebe Fletcher's benevolence during the war. Notably, Johnson stated that she merited praise from the Americans, not the British forces who occupied the city for more than 2.5 years. We might imagine, therefore, that Phoebe attended men wounded during the bloody siege of 1780, and then comforted those confined within the several prison ships anchored in the harbor throughout the long occupation. What contact or commerce she had with British soldiers, officers, and loyalists in Charleston during the early 1780s is currently unknown, but might possibly be discovered with further research. I have not yet found any reference to Phoebe Fletcher among the sparse extant records of life in Charleston during the years immediately after the British evacuation of December 1782. In the autumn of 1785, however, a local newspaper published a notice related to an undocumented series of curious cultural events. An advertisement in the Charleston Evening Gazette invited the community to an elegant ball to take place on the evening of October 10th at what was then called No. 12 Pinckney Street, a building now long gone. The soiree was described as being for the benefit of Miss Phoebe Fletcher, but this was no charity event. Rather, it was probably the conclusion of a subscription series of entertainments for which she played the role of both hostess and performer. As commonly seen in theatrical and concert series of that era, the benefit in question was a sort of gratuitous reward for Phoebe's hospitality and/or management of the series. 1 week later, the editors of the Evening Gazette published an audacious review of Phoebe Fletcher's elegant ball in Pinckney Street under the heading Alfresco Intelligence. The remarkable text contains exotic and romantic details that echo the contemporary European fascination with the Near East, alluding to an Ottoman or Turkish harem in the same manner as Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart's 1782 opera The Abduction from the Seraglio. Peppered with libidinous double entendres, the text depicts a hedonistic soiree hosted by a talented woman well known to her inebriated guests. Quote, "On Monday se'night, that is, 7 nights ago, a subscription ball for the benefit of Miss Phoebe Fletcher was given at her apartments in Pinckney Street. The saloon and drawing room were ornamented with festoons of myrtles and gold leaf, and elegantly variegated with tasty interspersions of natural and artificial flowers, a handsome display of embossed and fashionable plate, the dazzling beauties of the ladies in their newest charms and dresses, numerous wax tapers well placed and luxuriantly reflecting the gay scene in rich mirrors, gave an air of enchantment to the whole, and carried imagination to the paradise of Mahomet, where all true believers are promised 27 wives apiece. An Ethiopian band, that is, a band of black musicians, lulled the soul to peace and soft delight, whilst the fair hostess handed about several kinds of rich wines, and when anybody drank to her health, she curtsied in a most becoming manner, looking at the same time so prim as if butter would not melt in her mouth. The hackneyed, vulgar custom of supper gave way to the more modern one of tea, to which, by way of relish, was added cold tongues, oysters, ham, salt herrings, ornamented with little sprigs of parsley. The ladies could not swallow a morsel, but the gentlemen were not so nice. They threw down large mouthfuls, diluting their food with bumpers of generous wine, until, at last, some of them were of opinion that the room was running round and round. A song being called, as soon as silence could be procured, a young lady attempted, 'Love's the greatest bliss below,' but having a monstrous cold did not give so much satisfaction as could be wished. However, Miss Phoebe made amends by singing several songs as clear as a bell. The ladies now began to tuck up their gowns and get everything in order for dancing. The most select and admired cotillions, rigadoons, and country dances were performed with tolerable exactness. Some of the nymphs were a little at a loss in crossing over, but then they were as easy as could be when they figured in. Two young ladies went through an allemande in the Asiatic taste. Their contortions, animated gestures, and sympathetic manner tended to rouse in the spectators certain ideas. About 4 o'clock, the ladies retired, and the gentlemen followed hard after. End quote. Phoebe Fletcher must have hosted a number of similar events in Charleston during the 1780s that received far less public attention. Gossip about such decadent soirees apparently spread across the city, inspiring scorn from conservative neighbors and admiration from others. In his 1851 memoir, Joseph Johnson related the story of a young lady, probably a curious teenager, who aspired to join Phoebe's merry entourage. Johnson included this brief vignette to illustrate what he perceived as Miss Fletcher's contrite nature. "Many acts of her life," he wrote, "showed that she was fully sensible of her degraded state and wished to make amends, if possible." We may never know the identity of the girl in question, but the brief story proves Johnson's point. Quote, "A giddy, thoughtless young lady left the home of her respectable parents and repaired to that of Phoebe Fletcher, saying that she wished to live with her. Phoebe invited her into a room and locked the door on her, that she might not be exposed, then went off to the parents of the young lady, told them what she had done, and added that she knew too well the evils resulting from a loss of reputation and of virtuous society to countenance its sacrifice by anyone. The parents of the young lady took her home and not only treated her frailty with lenity, but with increased parental attentions. She not only repented and reformed, but became an exemplary mother of a respectable family. The secret never was whispered. I never heard the name of the family. Few ever heard of the incident, and when mentioned, it was only to give credit to the kind Magdalen." In mid-August 1786, Miss Fletcher advertised in local newspapers, quote, "to inform the gentlemen of both city and country that she has, for their accommodation, taken a large, pleasant, and commodious new house, number 16 Meeting Street, at present called City Hotel, where she assures such gentlemen as may favor her with their company that they will at all times have the best liquors and attendants the city can afford, with tea, coffee, beefsteaks, etc., by a professed cook, and relishes at all times." End quote. Owing to the repeated renumbering of Charleston street addresses in centuries past, it would be extremely difficult, but not necessarily impossible, to identify the present location of Phoebe's City Hotel or of her other residences. Subsequent public notices published in 1787 demonstrate that she held a one-year license from the City Council of Charleston to retail spirituous liquors and to keep a billiard table at her Meeting Street premises, but they also inform us that she had not renewed her liquor license at the end of the year. Unable or unwilling to purchase a fixed abode for her business and residence, Phoebe rented rooms and was apparently obliged to move house from time to time. In January 1788, Phoebe Fletcher advertised that she had opened a coffee house and tavern at a site then identified as number 39 Elliott Street, quote, "where the public may depend upon always meeting with good entertainment, liquors of the best collection, and every attention to their comfort and accommodation on the most reasonable terms," end quote. 3 months later, however, she sold a significant quantity of household goods to an obscure mariner named John Magnell. Whether this transaction represented the liquidation of Phoebe's business or the division of property with a departing partner is now unknown. At any rate, the surviving bill of sale provides a valuable snapshot of her private chambers. For £30 sterling, Fletcher sold, quote, "one feather bed, two mattresses, one bedstead, one lot 15 Windsor chairs, three blankets, three deal tables, one Dutch table, three mahogany tables, seven pictures, one commode, one looking glass, one trunk of clothes, nine boxes, one bar, 10 iron pots, two stew pans, two dozen plates, one dozen knives and forks, four tubs, one cooler, one pail, two pair of iron dogs, 10 tumblers, two decanters, two fish dishes, one set of china, one dozen of wine glasses, three window curtains, four candlesticks, and a pair of silver sugar tongs, and five silver teaspoons. 9 weeks later, some unknown intruder, or perhaps an invited guest, robbed Phoebe's residence on the evening of the 1st of July, 1788, taking three silver teaspoons, feather-edged, one of which bore the hallmark of Charleston silversmith William Whiteman, and, she said, is marked P.F., while the others are Philadelphia-made spoons. She offered a handsome reward for the return of the spoons, which might or might not have formed part of the property sold earlier to John Magnell. According to the published Charleston Directory of 1790, Phoebe Fletcher's next residence was at No. 5 Barreford Street, now Fulton Street, in the center of what was then a racially diverse working-class neighborhood called Dutchtown. That same year, the first federal census of the United States recorded her presence at an unspecified address in the urban Charleston parishes of St. Philip and St. Michael. Miss Fletcher was identified as the head of a household that included just two free white females of unspecified ages. The identity of her housemate is entirely unknown. We might imagine that this mystery woman could have been a servant, a protege, or perhaps even Phoebe's domestic partner. Considering this last-mentioned possibility, one might revisit Joseph Johnson's narrative with a fresh perspective. Perhaps the root of Phoebe's nonconformity was not necessarily humiliation, but a rejection of men and the patriarchal framework that abridged her freedom of expression. Rather than a delicate victim, she might have been an assertive woman who craved an independent life beyond the constraints of 18th-century propriety. Instead of a pious Magdalene, perhaps she had more in common with the 20th-century fictional bonne vivante Auntie Mame. The final piece of evidence relating to Phoebe's life appeared during Charleston's first post-war horse racing season in early March 1791. Through the local newspapers, she announced that she had taken charge of booth number 6 at a newly created venue called Washington Racecourse, now Hampton Park, where she offered, quote, for the entertainment of the gentlemen in general and her old friends in particular, the very best liquors of every kind, together with the best provisions prepared after the most elegant manner, and in this way humbly solicits the attention of the public, end quote. Phoebe's attendance at the inauguration of Washington Racecourse proved to be her final public campaign. Whether she was in declining health or fit as a fiddle at that time is now unknown, but her life ended some days later. According to a very brief notice published in the Charleston newspaper, Phoebe Fletcher died on the 26th of March, 1791. Curiously, a Philadelphia magazine published a brief mention of her death a few weeks later, a fact suggesting that she might have had friends or family in the city of brotherly love. The cause of death is lost to history, so we can only speculate about the events leading to her demise. Her name does not appear among the extant registers of churches in urban Charleston, though she might have been buried in the countryside, or perhaps was interred in the city's public cemetery on the west side of the peninsula. Similarly, I can find no last will and testament for Phoebe Fletcher, and no inventory of her estate, suggesting that either she had no possessions worth mentioning, or perhaps that the local government chose to ignore the tangible relics of a woman living beyond the pale of polite society. At least some of her neighbors paid their respects at Phoebe's graveside. Such was the general respect for her goodness of heart, recalled Joseph Johnson in 1851, that many of the most respectable inhabitants attended her funeral. Phoebe Fletcher was an independent, unconventional woman living on the fringes of gentrified society of late 18th century Charleston. Although some in that community might have sneered at her exuberant lifestyle and the company she kept, others remembered the acts of kindness she displayed during the darkest days of the Revolution. We owe much of our knowledge of Phoebe Fletcher to the antebellum prose of Joseph Johnson, who also provided a fitting benediction to conclude this brief biography. Peace to her memory. May he who can best judge of the frailties of our nature cast the mantle of pardon over her sins and reward her good deeds. Charleston County Public Library is your home for local history. To explore our resources and programs, and to read an illustrated transcript of this podcast, point your web browser to ccpl.org. Thanks for listening to the Charleston Time Machine. This is Nick Butler, and I'll see you in the future.